This is the value. This is the impact. This is the importance of these conversations. When people are hurting, we need to empower them to experience all of those emotions and feelings and not feel like they've done anything wrong, not feel like they need, not be made to feel like they've got to apologize, but just to experience that. Because crying and vulnerability, in my experience, is a different emotion, but it's no different to laughing and joy. We don't apologize when we laugh. We need to stop apologizing when we cry.
Whether it's the clothes you wear to work or a metaphor for putting up a front, we all wear a uniform. But often there's a lot going on behind the uniform, and many of us are reluctant to express how we are really feeling.
Each week on Behind the Uniform, Dr. Izzy Smith and Captain Hugo Tovey will be joined by a special guest as they talk openly and honestly about their experiences with mental health. Nothing will be off limits, so prepare yourself for tears, laughter and goosebumps.
Welcome back, everyone, to Behind the Uniform. It's a great day, Iz, and I'm very, very excited with our guest today.
Me too, Hugo. Since we started this podcast last year, this guest that we had today was one of the first people I thought, we've got to get him on. He is an amazing person with a very big wealth of personal and professional experience in the mental health space. He's also someone I consider a friend and someone I look up to. So if you haven't guessed it yet, our guest is Wayne Schwarz, who in himself, he's a, you know, a football great. He played in the, you know, AFL for over 14 years, won a flag. How's my football logo? Won a flag with the Roos in 1996 before moving to my beloved team, the Sydney Swans. And through all of this, he put on his uniform and was actually battling really severe mental illness. And he came out and talked about it publicly in the early 2000s and then moved into the mental health space. Started initially working in, you know, the sports area, focusing on, you know, the well-being of football players in the sports space before starting the Pucker Up organization, which is a program, you know, dedicating to ending suicide, but doing that differently. That all sounds very formal. Wayne is also a ripper cyclist and someone I consider a mate, and I'm really excited for the chat today.
Oh, thank you very much, Izzy, and hello, Hugo. Nice to be on your podcast. It would be totally unacceptable if I had have said, no, I don't want to join Behind the Uniform, given the fact that Izzy's joined Pucker Up podcast on two occasions. You know, I'm really looking forward to the conversation that we have with both of you today. So thanks very much for the invitation to come on.
Thank you, Wayne. Thank you. As you said, you're one of the guests that we were so excited to get on. And I think you almost epitomize what this whole podcast stands for. And we're going to get stuck right into that throughout the next 40 minutes or so and delve really deep into your story and the amazing work you're doing now. But we always start off with all our guests. A nice little way to understand who our guests are, we think, is by asking you, Wayne, what you are doing when you are at your happiest.
I'm in tune with my thoughts, feelings, emotions. I'm doing something with purpose and passion, and that could be presenting, hosting a podcast. It could be delivering a webinar. It could be engaging with people on this really important topic. But it could also be me on my push bike on my own, in my own space. It could be me with my three children. It could be me with my partner. I think when I'm at my best, what am I doing? I'm enjoying what I'm doing. It doesn't matter what I'm doing. I'm just in the moment. I'm in a really good headspace physically, mentally, and emotionally. And I'm just enjoying whatever it is that I'm doing and the opportunity that's providing me.
That is wonderful, Wayne. And it's a little bit different to some of the other answers we've had. And I like what you said, I'm doing things that I enjoy. And that's really simple. And sometimes I think we overcomplicate happiness and purpose and life. And we need to break it down a little bit and go, you know, life is about doing things we're passionate and we enjoy. We don't need to make it success much more complicated than that.
No, I agree with that, Izzy. One of the things that I've reflected on quite a lot over the last 18 months, for those who don't know, I live in Melbourne, so it's been particularly tough for Melburnians and Sydney-siders. But one of the things that I've reflected on, but also see, we seem to fall into this trap of competing for things or pursuing things. And I think pursuing the notion of happiness is fraught with danger, because it's this never-ending race. If I get a new car, a new watch, some new clothes, a bigger house, if I get a new job, if I get a promotion, I'll be happier. The way I'm looking at that now is happiness is an experience, but joy is something that you can experience consistently. And I've started to integrate this in the webinars. I've done a lot of webinars over the last 18 months, and I'm encouraging and challenging people. As we grow up, we lose that sense of joy, or we lose the connection to joy, because we're grown-ups, we're adults. And I think it's never been more important that we give ourselves permission, even as grown-ups. And what I say to audiences is, what was the thing that gave you the most joy that you haven't done for a long time? And whatever that is, go back, reconnect with it, and do it. Because when you do something that gives you joy, and that's one of the reasons why I like cycling, I'm just happier on a push bike. I'm a happier person. I'm a better person. I'm a better father, partner, business owner. It just has so many positive impacts on my life. And that's one of the reasons why I cycle. I don't mind what people do. I just mind that people do something that brings them the joy. Because when we feel joy, we are naturally happier. We feel better about ourselves. And then we're giving a better version of ourselves to all of those other important relationships in our lives.
I love that sort of that detail, Wayne, that you went into then. And what I particularly got out of that, and it's something that I constantly talk about with mates, is the materialistic things that we think will bring us happiness. And with that question we've asked our guests, we've never got that response of, what are you doing at your happiness? You know, often it doesn't involve money. It doesn't involve, you know, being on your expensive yacht or driving your expensive car. It's typically doing something you personally enjoy, whether that be with family, friends, by yourself, but being in that moment. So that was a really, really refreshing answer. Great way to sort of start the episode, Wayne. And I think it's important for those who don't know who Wayne Schwoss is, they don't know your story, much about sort of your football career. We might just delve into that a bit, Wayne, and go back to what led you into a career in AFL football, and then talk about sort of the highs of and the lows of what you went through in your football career.
Yeah, thank you, Hugo. At the age of 16, I was living in a place called Warrnambool, which is country Victoria, about 3 hours west of Melbourne. And I was playing senior football with a local football club, and three of my teammates, similar ages, had been invited down to train and play for the Fitzroy Football Club, which no longer exists in the AFL. I'd been invited down to train once, and then it was fed back to me that I wasn't good enough to play AFL football. So I made the decision at that stage that I was going to join the army. And I got all my paperwork, I'd submitted the application, and I can still recall this day in the middle of 1995, I was in year 10, it was the middle of the football season that I was playing, so I was 16 playing with seniors. Hopped into my car, my mum's car. She picked me up after school, and I just, right, I'm ready to join the army. I'm ready to go. She goes, what about footy? And I said, look, the armed forces play footy against each other. So army, air force, navy, I'll get my footy fixed, but I want to go and join the army. And she said something at the time, which I'll never forget. She goes, why don't you give it 4 more weeks? And I thought that was a really strange thing for a mum to say, but out of respect, I said, yeah, okay. What I didn't know was the North Melbourne Football Club had been coming down and watching me play football over that period of time. 4 weeks later, they landed on my door, asked if I'd play. I didn't join the army, obviously. And then I made the decision at the age of 17 that I'd move to Melbourne in 1986 to pursue my dream. And my dream was to play football. And from 1986 until 1993, life was great. I played in premierships in the under-19s. I was captain, started playing in the seniors, debuted in 1988, and then had played 98 games of football, and it was an amazing experience. I was fit, I was competitive, I was starting to believe that I was good enough. And 98 games of football into my career, so I'm 5 years into my senior career in 1993. I'm vice captain of the football club, so it's a fairly big honour. And I'm driving home on a Monday night, and it was the 26th of July 1993, and it was about 9 o'clock at night, and I'm waiting at a set of traffic lights, and I burst out crying. And up until that moment, I'd only ever seen my dad cry once. My dad's a 78-year-old old school man who internalised a lot of things, and that's not a criticism. But when you're a young boy growing up, you go, you tend to mirror the behaviours of influential people, and in my case, influential men. And I effectively had a nervous breakdown in the car, and 2 weeks later I was diagnosed with depression. From the 99th game of my career until the end of my 282nd game, which is 184 more games of football, which equates to 10 and a half years of my footballing career, which represents the final two-thirds of my football career, I ultimately live with anxiety, depression, obsessive compulsive disorder. And from 1993 until the end of 1997, I live with insidious suicidal ideation. And through that period, state of origin representative, premiership player, as Izzy mentioned nicely before, I was vice captain. And on the surface, most people would have suspected that I was happy, healthy, and successful. The truth of the matter was that I spent the remaining 10 and a half years of my life, and I'd never thought of it this way because I've always talked about the mask, but I effectively had a uniform on. It was my protective mechanism. And I only wore that, and I wore that every day from the 9th of August 1993 until October of 2005. I wore that uniform every single day. And I invested more energy and more effort into hiding and lying that I had mental health conditions to pretend that I was happy and healthy as opposed to my football career. And I never missed a game of footy. I never missed a training session. But I invested so much energy into the facade of lies to protect what I thought was more important. So I achieved a lot. I had a fantastic career. But from the date of diagnosis until October of 2005, there were four people that knew what was going on. My ex-wife, the doctor who diagnosed me, who's still my doctor today, 35 years since we've connected together. He's become a mentor, a trusted advisor. He's a man I love as much as my father. Those two people kept me alive, my GP and my ex-wife for 4 years. And then at the age of 29, I was playing at Sydney. I'm about to win my third best and fairest. So once again, another example, he's really successful, he's still achieving. But I had an epiphany during a training session. And the epiphany was I'm in the same miserable position I was 6 years earlier. And I've not done one thing to help myself. And I made a decision I wish I'd made 6 years earlier. And the decision was, once training's finished, I'm going to walk into the doctor's rooms and I'm going to tell them the truth. And I actually asked for help for the first time in 6 years. And that he became the third person. And then the fourth person that knew was this beautiful, amazing lady psychologist who I worked 4.5 years with in Sydney to understand the conditions and to slowly but surely and sometimes painfully learn how they were impacting my life. And then learn to develop the skill set and the confidence which allowed me to reclaim my health back. But I never spoke to my parents. I never told my sister, never told my friends, family, teammates, coaches, employers, staff, support staff, sponsors. I didn't tell anybody. And the reason I did not tell anybody outside of those four people who knew out of necessity was because I lived with this paralyzing fear that if people knew the truth, I'd lose respect, I'd lose relationships, I'd lose my income, and I'd lose my career. So in my mind, I assumed incorrectly that if people knew the truth, I was more worried about what would they think, what would they say, and what would they do. What I've learned over the journey, which is 26 years old, is that I've lost four relationships over that time. That's a small price to pay, and that's a price I'm prepared to pay by empowering myself to look after my mental health and emotional well-being. I was convinced that I'd lose family, friends, really important relationships. No, I didn't. But I spent 12 years believing that that's what the outcome would be. And that's one of the reasons why I do the work that I do is I don't want people to wait 6 days, let alone 6 months, heaven forbid 6 years, before they ask for help because it's not worth it.
Wayne, I know your story quite well. And there's a few things I would like to ask. What do you think led to you having such significant mental illness? You have had OCD and was there a family history? And I guess leading on from that, I know you once said you almost didn't believe the diagnosis, that you couldn't believe that could be true. And maybe just unpacking why you had those own stigmas around mental illness.
One of the fundamental things that contributed to my journey with mental health, which I'm incredibly grateful for, by the way, because I've learned so much about myself and I've learned more about mental health and the importance of looking after your well-being. When I look back on my time as an athlete and a young boy, I was conditioned to be a male based on other people or society's expectations. That wasn't mine. I didn't design it, but I lived it, I learnt it, and I behaved it. But then also overlaying masculinity and what that meant was I was trained to be a football player. So I could cope with stress, and there's stress at the elite level in a combative sport. It's very stressful. There's a lot of pressure, but I could cope with stress. There's no better example in my career that I was a premiership player while being in the middle of a four-year battle with suicidal ideation, hiding obsessive compulsive disorder, anxiety and depression, and still performing at an incredibly high level. But I was taught to train with stress in one area of my life. But when I look back on the 4 or 5 year buildup to that date where I had a breakdown, I can look back and say, these periods of overwhelming sadness, where I was really low in my mood, not feeling engaged, not feeling connected, feeling quite isolated, I thought that was normal. I thought that happened to everybody. But with the benefit of maturity and reflection, I look back and I go, stress was impacting my life during that period. I just didn't have an ability of recognizing that there's stress in my life. What's underpinning it? What's causing it? Can I address it myself? And if I can't, I need to go and see the doctor. So I didn't have that ability. And that's something that I've worked incredibly hard on. And that's something that I continually challenge audiences. Develop the self-awareness so you can understand when stress is presenting physically, mentally, and emotionally. And when you do that, you can make decisions earlier, which means you mitigate the impact of the stress, move back to being healthy and well, or more profoundly, you can prevent a mental health condition from manifesting. I just didn't have the skill set to recognize that I was under enormous stress.
Wayne, there is so much to unpack with what you're saying and so many valuable take-homes and advice for listeners. But what I just want to delve into, and it's something I'm, you know, personally just struggling to truly understand, is that you talk about how you had severe mental illness and you were suicidal, but then to be able to then put on that mask or uniform, like you call it, to then perform on such a big stage, I think is extraordinary. But do you just want to just delve into the detail on what your worst day would actually look like and how you could almost just flick that switch from one moment being so low, suicidal, and then just put on that front? It's extraordinary.
Yeah, I know. Look, I appreciate that, Hugo. And that's probably the thing that I'm proudest of the most, that I was able to achieve some great individual and team achievements and never missing a football game, never missing a training session whilst living with these conditions. But I didn't have the ability of flicking the switch. I had no idea what my state of mind was going to be every time I went to play a game of football. And there were days where I played where I was there physically, but I can honestly say I was not there mentally or emotionally. I was detached. And if anyone's lived with these type of conditions, you'll understand what that means. But I was there, but I wasn't there. There were periods in my career where I was so angry and bitter about what was in my life and the world. I felt very sorry for myself that I would play incredibly aggressive. I'm not an aggressive person. I'm a very soft, sensitive, compassionate person. But part of my football career, there was a lot of anger coming out of me because I was angry that I had these conditions. I was angry that no one really understood it. I was just angry. I felt that I didn't deserve to be living with these conditions.
So you quite literally took that out on a football field.
Very much so. But then there were other times, and I had no indication when these moments would happen. But I can still remember games where I was in the moment. I was doing what I loved. I was enjoying the experience of playing a game that I've loved all my life. And in those rare moments, and there were a lot less of those moments than the days where I was distracted or dealing with these conditions. But on those days where I was in the moment, my mind wasn't trying to defeat me with the negative dialogue that I lived with for such a long period of time. At its worst, I can remember being at Etihad Stadium. For those, it's the second stadium in Melbourne. I can remember playing for the Sydney Swans and running out on the ground to warm up and looking at the crowd saying, I just don't want to be here. I don't have the energy to do this. This might sound really strange, but I remember doing a training run at the TAN, which is around the Botanical Gardens in Melbourne. And I can vividly recall watching myself do the training run, but from a view up above myself. It was almost this
depersonalization.
Yeah, I was watching myself, but the person I was watching, there was nothing in him.
Can I interrupt for a second? Because I'm going to put my medical hat on and talk about the symptom you're feeling, which is depersonalization. It's like you're looking at yourself, but it's watching someone in a movie and you're not feeling that person. It's like you're watching yourself almost in slow motion. And that's a really classic symptom of burnout. And I'm thinking about what you were going through, Wayne, and you would have been putting in so much emotional and mental energy to to put on this front that I am fine, you know, and hide it from everyone apart from, you know, your wife and some, you know, medical specialists. And depression often is low self-esteem, low self-worth, whereas burnout is more low value in what you're doing, but they can interplay. But you're going out and you're saying, I can't be bothered. What's the point? What's the value of this? Which does have crossover with burnout. And for people, burnout is really common. And I think we are experiencing a lot more burnout this year. And I just want to say that depersonalization that you are feeling is a really classic symptom of burnout, as is not seeing the value in what you're doing. And, you know, as a doctor, I've had that. And it's like, gosh, if a doctor who's literally trying to help people even save a life doesn't see the value in what they're doing, that shows something's pretty serious. And then the third symptom of burnout is that lack of emotion, that, you know, you don't get excited or sad, you're almost just flat. So I can see that you definitely had some symptoms of burnout. And I just want, if anyone is listening, that these signs or symptoms go, hold on, that sounds a bit familiar, to recognize, you know, that is what you could be feeling. And it is a bit different to depression, but they can overlap.
Yeah, that description sums me up at that time, Izzy. I had no self-worth, no self-value, saw no positive contribution that I was making, yet I was a vice-captain of an AFL football club playing AFL footy.
Every boy's dream in life.
Yeah, right. But I wasn't happy. And then the burnout, I can relate to that, because the energy invested into playing and training at that level is tough. The energy invested into pretending and putting up a facade is tough. But even in my quiet moments when I was alone, I was exhausted because I was grappling with what I was thinking and saying to myself internally. So there was a lot of that. The other word that I would add into that, though, is that I was completely detached from my emotions and my feelings. And this is something else that I talk about a lot, and that is I was conditioned to disconnect emotionally because I was an AFL football player. Tough, strong, aggressive, combative, confrontational, angry, but don't be emotional, don't be sensitive, and don't cry. So one of the things that has helped me tremendously over the last 5 to 6 years is I have connected with all of my emotions. And the irony of this, Hugo and Izzy, is that I always knew from a young age that I was a sensitive, caring person. And all I ever wanted through my football career was love and acceptance. I didn't get that. I played football in an era where you were criticized all the time. It was more critical feedback than there was positive feedback. So I'm looking for love and acceptance, but I got neither of that. And that just conditioned me further to disconnect emotionally. Overlay that with the fact that real men don't cry. What a crock of shit that is. I've learned that now. And now I'm this person that is emotionally connected and expressive. I can't get the past back, but I look back on that experience and go, here was this soft, gentle kid who's loving and caring. To be accepted is really important to him. He goes into an AFL environment, and I'm not criticizing the environment or people that coached me, but I didn't get what I needed. And that had a profoundly negative impact on myself and my experience, because I, for a long time, never thought that I was worthy of love. That's something I still work on. I see a psychiatrist every fortnight, started again this year, one of the best decisions I've made. And he said, what is at the core of your self-worth is this belief that you're not deserving of love. That was conditioned out of me. And that's something that I'll continue to work on, because I think that I'm absolutely deserving of that. Some days are better than others. But I think it's a constant challenge for a lot of people that we live in this world of comparison. We need to stop comparing ourselves to other people, or we need to stop allowing other things or other people to compare us to other people. We are unique and worthy as we are.
Wayne, you just mentioned just then what's taught you these valuable things in the journey, and it's obviously taken time. But you had an incredible AFL career. You achieved the pinnacle of success in the AFL world, and there was that powerful photo of you in your North Melbourne colours, your arms are raised in the air, premiership medal around you with a massive smile on your face, and you came out many years later saying, this is what suicidal looks like. And it was that kind of epiphany moment to people to realize, you know, there are many different ways, shapes and forms that people can look, be acting, be doing to be suicidal. And I think that was extremely powerful. But at what time or moment, if there was a moment, did things change? Did things start to change? Did you start to express your emotions? You started to have that professional help? You know, now you obviously have a fortnightly psychiatrist, you know, you run your own amazing foundation, Pucker Up. But back then, when you were at your absolute lowest of lows, what changed?
Yeah, really good question. There's a few things that contributed to the change, Hugo. One was realising during a training session at the age of 29, I needed help, June of 1999, asking for help off the back of that training session. That was one. And then fortunately for me, and Izzy and I've talked about this on our podcast, I was lucky enough to be introduced to the right psychologist for me at the time. Her name is Lisa Lampe, and she's a beautiful woman. The reason why she's a beautiful woman is whether I was the first, the middle, or the last patient at her practice in North Sydney, every time I walked into her office, I felt that I was just not a name on a manila folder. I felt that when I walked in there, she was genuinely invested into my health and recovery. That was critical. And she made me feel special. She saw me, she acknowledged me, she listened to me, and she supported me. I spent 4.5 years working with Lisa. And for the first 3 years, it was weekly. And it was the same thing every time, 45 minutes to an hour. I walk in and she'd have the biggest box of Kleenex tissues. And I was not a crier, but I would walk in there and I would say the same thing to her. I was almost begging her. And I said the same thing for 3 years. I said, Lisa, will this ever go away? Will the colour ever come back into my life? You know, when I walk outside in Sydney, I want to feel the warmth of the sun. The sun is my energy source, but I want to feel the sensation of the warmth and the heat flooding my body because I'd lost that. I said, when it's in spring and summer, I want to just stop and notice the beauty of all the flowers blooming, the green of the grass. I'd lost that because my conditions had made it grey. Everything was grey. I'd lost that connection. I was disconnected again. And she kept saying to me, yes, I believe it will. Yes, I believe it will. And I didn't believe her. I didn't believe her. And one day on a Tuesday, the day before the next session, about the 3 year mark, I'm driving along Military Road, North Shore of Sydney. And it's a beautiful summer's day and I'm driving and I pulled the car over and I stopped the car on Military Road. And I said, shit, I haven't had a negative thought for 5 minutes. And at that moment, I thought progress. For the first time in a long time, I thought I've actually made progress here. Then the athlete kicked in. I walked in the door the next day to see Lisa. She goes, how are you going? I said, don't need the Kleenex tissues, need to sit down. She goes, tell me what happened. And I explained to her, I said, I had 5 minutes where my thought process wasn't negative. How do we get the 5 to 30? Do you reckon we can go from 30 to an hour? Can an hour get to 3? Can I get to a half a day, a full day? She said, yeah, you can. I said, well, I want to work on doing that. And that was the first moment since 1993 when I was diagnosed that I actually thought and started to think without believing it, I might get in control of this. And they were the things that eventually led to me doing more work. But that still was, I started working with Letha in 1998. That was 2002. It was still 3 years before I sat down with my family for the first time in 12 and a half years and had a conversation. That was another liberating moment.
So, Wayne, I'm going to talk back about some of the things you said because it's something I've learned a lot and maybe some listeners will also identify with. You said that you were searching for love and acceptance and you were always striving for more. And as someone I've realized for me, as a child, that's when I was good, I was loved. But if I did bad, I felt like I was a bad person. So it set me up to think for me to be loved and accepted, I need to constantly be achieving more. And I see it in myself. I'm like, yo, you can't just be a doctor. You've got to become a specialist. You can't just do a marathon. You've got to become an ultra marathon, whatever. And there's always something more that you can be striving for. And that's a really toxic place to be because there's just no end. And if you've got to break that chain and realize I can just be myself and be loved and worthy. And that might not be the same for everyone. What we're talking about is a concept called a schema. Mm-hmm. And different people have different schemas and their ways of thinking we developed as a child that may have been protective of us. If our dad only gave us praise when we did good, that helped us feel good. So it might have worked when we're little, but not into adult life. And you said you worked with the therapist and she made you feel like you were enough. And just talking about therapists, and this is something Hugo and I have talked a lot about in the episodes of, you know, men might see a doctor or they might see a therapist and they don't have a good experience. And that can be so jarring because they've been building up for years and years of this stress and this depression. And they finally take this first really vulnerable, powerful step. And it's such a smack in the face if it doesn't go well. You know, I've got the advantage of having a partner who is a mental health specialist. And I know he has told me that, you know, that he's not my therapist, by the way, there was nothing dodgy, But the most important predictor of success in therapy, it's not if they do CBT, it's not if they do some type of whiz-bang, new type of theory. It's actually the therapeutic relationship between the client and the therapist. So the most important thing is if you click with them. And if you don't, say someone new, because it's probably never going to work out. Because the most important thing for you and Lisa was that she cared about you and she was invested, mm-hmm. and that gave you, you know, whatever it was that you needed to then, you know, look forward. And you couldn't feel joy and, you know, in inverted commas, I say toxic masculinity. But I think, you know, the extreme end of these toxic, you know, masculine traits of how men are supposed to behave is that they can't even feel joy, you know, that something good happens in their life and they can't feel joy about it. And I think that's a really extreme end of not being able to show emotions. And, you know, it seems like you'd got to that point.
Before I want to hear your thoughts on that, Wayne, it's so, so fundamental. We highlight that it's so important to stick at either a therapist, or if it's not right for you, find another therapist.
I worked with Lisa for 4.5 years, but when I was still playing at North Melbourne, I was referred to go and see 2 male psychologists. it's quite funny when I think back about the extents that I went to, but every time I would have to go, I had an appointment to go to the clinic. I had some conditions in order for me to go there. It was either the first or the last appointment. Less people in the waiting room. The receptionists were never allowed to say Wayne Swass. It was only Wayne. And I wore a cap and I had The Age. So for those people that don't live in Melbourne, The Age was this massive 2-page paper, which when you opened it right up, it was about 1 meter wide. I had it as my constant companion. And I'd sit in the furthest corner and I'd open up the paper. I wasn't reading it. I was hiding myself.
It's like something out of those cheesy inspector movies where they've got the fake moustache and the big glasses. You need the music in the background, like the sorry.
Exactly. And that's or the Benny Hill music. The problem, so I was so ashamed of myself during that period. But the other problem, and the 2 male psychologists, I'm sure that they had the best intentions. But here's part of the other problem that I had. I never had one of these conversations as a child. I never had one of these conversations as a teenage boy. I never had one of these conversations as an adult man. I didn't start having these conversations until around the age of 45. So how does an AFL athlete sit down with another man and talk about feelings, emotions, insecurities, fears? How do you do that when you don't have a language? And that, I lied. I just blatantly lied every time I was with these people, because I didn't know how to communicate about feelings and emotions because I didn't have that skill set. One of the things that's been fundamental to my healing journey, which continues today, is I've developed a language made up of words which represent me and that are important to me, which when you put them together, give me a vocabulary which allows me to go, what am I feeling right now? What is the emotion? How am I thinking about it? Do I know what's causing it? Have I got the tools available for me that allows me to deal with that? And if I don't, who do I need to talk to? But during that period when I played at North Melbourne, I couldn't talk to people because I didn't know how to. The night I had a nervous breakdown, I sat in my car for 1.5 hours outside of my house where my fiance was sitting. I couldn't go in there. And then the only reason I was able to go inside after 1.5 hours because I had no more tears. And what I did, and I've talked about this publicly, I walked inside and I sat in the room with her and I didn't say anything. It's not that I didn't want to talk, but I didn't know how to talk about what had just happened. So I didn't say anything because I didn't know how to. And I think that's a challenge for a lot of people, including me.
And Wayne, you mentioned then you didn't know how to. And I think it's so important to highlight how we and society and organizations such as Pucker Up and Tomorrow Man is helping bridge that gap. And I recently saw you had a chat with a guy called Tom Harkin, who is the founder of Tomorrow Man, who I love, Tom. Fortunate to have had several interactions with him. And it's great because what they're doing is that preventative space of getting in early with these vulnerable young men and having these conversations about emotions and crying and what masculinity looks like at a young age. Mm. And I'm interested to hear if you think if you had that at a young age, how different it may have been, but how important it is going forward to continue to have these conversations.
Yeah, if I think about that from my own perspective and journey, Hugo, would it have made a difference? I'm not 100% sure because the world was very different back then. I was certainly very different. I think the world has fundamentally shifted. which is a good thing. So would it have helped me? I'm not sure. It certainly would have helped me if I had have had more emotionally connected and expressive male role models in my life. That would have perhaps given me permission to think that that's normal behaviour. And that's not a criticism of the influential men in my life, because those men have played a really important role. But I do absolutely, with every ounce and piece of energy I have available in me for the rest of my life, fundamentally believe that if we don't change the environments, if we don't change the definition and application of masculinity, we run the risk, and it still continues today, we run the risk of conditioning the next generation of men to behave in similar ways. If we don't start to empower the next generation of children, including the boys, to stay emotionally connected and expressive, we're going to have this ongoing issue of people in crisis and people who are hurting themselves. And I think it's grossly unfair, but also think that parents don't consciously choose to condition their kids, but they subconsciously parent their children in a similar way that they've been parented. And I'll give you a couple of examples. If you've got sons and daughters in your family, as parents, do we respond differently to our daughters crying, to our sons? And if we do, the question is why? If we respond to our daughters compassionately, lovingly, caringly, empathetically, and gently, then why wouldn't we extend that same response to our sons? Just because they're boys, different gender, does not mean they don't feel pain and they hurt. But if we sit there and condition our boys by saying, harden up, toughen up, that's not how a man behaves, we don't cry in this house, and we repeat those messages, over time what happens is we condition the child to disconnect emotionally. And the inherent risk comes after that. When the child feels pain and they're hurting, they either won't know what to do because they've lost connection to the emotions and the feelings, or they'll sit there absolutely petrified to do anything because they're worried about being criticized. And one other quick story I'll share with you about the value of this is, and I've got to do this quickly because this would normally take 10 to 15 minutes. 3 years ago, I met a young boy at the funeral of one of his best mates where I did the eulogy. His best mate, a boy I've known since he was five, tragically took his life. This young boy came up to me during the wake, asked if we could talk, said no problems. And there was 800 people there. He said, no, not here. Now, I've never asked him this, but my assumption is he picked the room out before he asked. So I followed him in, closed the door, kid burst out crying uncontrollably. He's 18, I'm 49. I could very quickly understand this kid was under some sort of emotional stress. Now, in this moment, I've got one of two choices. I may have said once upon a time, a long time ago, mate, cut it out. This is bullshit. You know, this is not how we behave. Get it together. I'm going to go and grab a beer and I'll come back. But I didn't. I could see that this boy was under stress. So I just said to this young boy, I said, whatever's happening right now and whatever's upsetting you, it's okay. I just need you to tell me what you need from me to help you right now. If you want some water, I'll get it. If you want me to stay here, I'm happy to stay here. If you need some space and some time, I'll give you that. He goes, don't leave. So I said, okay, I won't leave. So after about 15 minutes, he calmed himself down and he proceeded to tell me that 2 years earlier, at the age of 16, his dad died of a heart attack. So he went from the son, the brother, and the grandson in the house to the man of the house. He's trying to navigate his way through a world that's telling him to be a man, harden up, toughen up, don't be weak, don't be soft. And I opened up the conversation and said, who have you talked to about it? He goes, no one. So his mother, no, don't want to be a burden to her. Sister, who was a year older, no, she thinks I'm Superman. He saves everyone, doesn't need saving. And his grandmother, talk to her? No, why? Because this will kill her. Have you talked to your mates? No, don't want to lose them. Have you got a job? Yeah, I'm an apprentice chippy. Have you told your boss? No, why? I don't want to get sacked. So I'm condensing the story. And at the end of all of that, I said to him, then who have you talked to? He goes, no one. And I said, why are you talking to me? Now, this is a kid who had no idea what my response would be when he asked me if he could talk. And he very calmly said to me, because I know you won't judge me. Now, here's a boy for 2 years that internalized the pain, the loss, the grief, the hurt of his dad now not here in his life anymore. And for 2 years, he'd consciously chosen not to talk because he was worried, like I was, he'd be seen as weak or soft or lose respect. He took a great chance that day to ask another man without knowing what that man's response would be to talk. Now, this is not about me. This is about the message. Here's a kid who lived with that grief for 2 years but didn't have the courage or confidence to talk about what he was experiencing. I've shared that story every time for 3.5 years. And about 2 years ago, I was sharing that story in much more detail with Will Anderson on his podcast. And I said to Will in the podcast, I said, Will, I don't know the kid's name. I don't know where he lives. I don't know how he's going, but I desperately wish I did, because that kid has had a profound impact on my life personally, but on the work that we do. And a week later, the podcast gets uploaded and I get a series of direct messages on Instagram, and I've still got them. I've screenshotted them. And the first message came from a young boy called Jack, and it was Jack that I spoke with 2 years earlier. And his first message, quote unquote, verbatim, says, "That conversation at my mate's funeral saved my life." So here's proof that this is why we need to give opportunities to everyone, not just young people. People are hurting all the time. If we criticize them, judge them, label them, tell them to stop, we're actually denying them the opportunity of being a human being. But when we give people those safe, non-judgmental environments, that can change a person's life. Jack's now 21. He lives in an area 50 minutes from Melbourne. And last Christmas, I was taking my son down because he loves cricket to throw some balls at him. And we're about to drive into a footy ground. Three young boys around the age of 20, 21 walk in front of the car. The last one was Jack. Now, I hadn't seen Jack for 3 years before the funeral. Walks around the front to where my son was sitting. I'm going to swear, so here's a warning. He walks to the passenger side door. I wind the window down. And he leans in the window and goes, "I fucking love you." I said, "I love you too." He goes, "You have no idea what that conversation has done for my life." We said a very brief chat. Now, we've spoken in person twice. This is the value. This is the impact. This is the importance of these conversations. When people are hurting, we need to empower them to experience all of those emotions and feelings and not feel like they've done anything wrong, not feel like they need, not be made to feel like they've got to apologize, but just to experience that. Because crying and vulnerability, in my experience, is a different emotion, but it's no different to laughing and joy. We don't apologize when we laugh. We need to stop apologizing when we cry.
I'm just going to back up with what you said. So many people are hurting, and we don't know that other people are hurting because we don't talk about it. And I work in diabetes, and the amount of people that break down to me about their mental health, because it's a safe space, because it's not, I'm not a psychiatrist, I'm not a psychologist, I'm their diabetes doctor. And there are so many people that are hurting. And this is a good segue to go into talking about Pucker Up and what you're doing, because now we have awareness. We know that lots of people are hurting. People are dying from suicide. People are feeling like they can't, you know, reach out to a mate, be vulnerable, but now we need to be taking the next step. And you talked about, you know, parents, when you were growing up, they didn't know. And now people are parenting in the same way that, you know, they were parented, and people need education. And often people ask me, what's some of the best things you've done for your mental health? And I say, I read heaps of books, because I just had no idea what I was feeling or what I was going through. So I guess, you know, moving on from that, could you tell us a bit about Pucker Up? I know their goal is suicide prevention, and you talk about with a focus on well-being. And someone listening could that think, oh, well-being, that's your smoothie that your, you know, partner just brought in and some yoga, and then suicide prevention, that sounds really serious. But can you talk about the merging of those two concepts with Pucker Up?
So what does Pucker Up do? We're incredibly good at storytelling. We take complex issues, we make them relatable, we create safe environments that invites people in to participate in these conversations. And there's been a lot of work done by a lot of organisations across the country to have more conversations. Are You Okay Day, Beyond Blue, you know, even Tomorrow Man, the Resilience Project. There's a lot of storytelling that is happening, which is great. My Due North has never deviated once. We want to end suicide. That is our goal. And I hope in my lifetime that we can close the doors of Pucker Up, because if we can, it means we've achieved the goal. That's ambitious. It's very optimistic. Some people might say it's not achievable, but if we don't set the goal, we'll never get it. So we're going to do everything we can. So the way that we end suicide, though, has been informed strategically. There's a lot of focus, a lot of investment, a lot of service delivery in the crisis space, and there needs to be. But we see a fundamental problem with the way that we've set up the sector and the way that we apply and approach mental health in this country historically. And that's not a criticism of anyone that works in the crisis space, because it's complex work, it's confronting, it's really challenging sometimes. But the problem that we see with the mental health sector is we wait until people present when they're sick before we intervene. And if you're not deemed sick enough, then you may not get admitted. Or if you're like me, you wait until you become really unwell before you start to think about what can I do. Then if you overlay that with the fact that, and this is a fact, 1 in 5 people live with a significant mental health condition in any 12-month period here in Australia. So pre-COVID, that's 20%. You're looking at 5 million people. You overlay COVID, I would suspect that the reality is the number is much higher now. Here in Victoria, I was a witness into the Royal Commission into the mental health sector in 2019. One of the three key overlaying recommendations that the commissioners found was that demand had outstripped capacity pre-COVID. So what that means is we don't have a system that can service the growing number of people that are unwell. So that's part of the problem. So with all of that information, we've looked at that and said, if we're in that space, we're just noise. So what we've done is very deliberately is we've moved ourselves upstream. And that is, if one in five people have a mental health condition, how do we help the 80% that don't stay healthy? So that's where we are focused. And we've gone from recognizing that storytelling is an important part in the focus, but just talking about it doesn't give people the opportunity of developing skill and capacity and confidence to look after their mental health. That then led to Pucker Up will always be a storytelling organization. But we now have a relationship with Melbourne University and the Centre for Wellbeing Science, which is a globally recognised research entity which focuses on positive psychology. So what we've now done is we've combined storytelling with clinically validated science-backed evidence program content, and we house that on a technology platform. So it's Pucker Up, it's Melbourne Uni and the Centre for Wellbeing Science, and a tech partner called Alfie. And the whole premise of the course, which is called Foundations of Wellbeing, has been designed to give people the opportunity to understand what does wellbeing look like? So it's different for all of us and it's intangible. What are the things that I'm good at already? So it's strengths-based, which is the foundational pillar of positive psychology. And everybody's got strengths. So how do we help you amplify your strengths? How do we help you develop skill sets that allow you to address some of your areas for improvement? I don't like the word weakness. And then how do we give you the confidence and capacity to begin to take ownership of your mental health and emotional wellbeing? And that's what we're doing, because we believe if we can deliver our program to as many people as we possibly can, then we're going to keep people healthy. And what frustrates me, and we've had this conversation before, Izzy, there seems to be so much focus on sickness and illness. That's not a good outcome for individual. There's not a good outcome for community. And that's not a good outcome for our society. So why don't we shift the focus away from crisis and go, what are we doing to keep people healthy? That is a fundamentally different outcome for the individual, families, communities, and societies. Everybody benefits when people are healthy.
And Wayne, I often say with that, and it's one of my favorite little quotes, is the prevention of thousands versus the crisis of hundreds. And I think it's what you're talking about sounds exactly like that. The whole early intervention, the prevention, and you mentioned the whole goal of zero suicides or eliminating suicide might not be achievable. Well, the work you're doing for Pucker Up and these workshop type programs and the power of storytelling and lived experience, you're going to go a hell of a long way in at least achieving that. So it's, you know, you should be bloody obviously proud of what you do, but I can't wait to see the progress you've done over the 5 years, but you'll continue to make. But I just want to ask you, if a listener's listening to this episode right now, and I'm sure there's already been so many valuable takeaways, they're listening to this right now on their little morning walk and they're hurting. This person's hurting, mm-hmm. right? And it's all good and well, we say, just talk to someone. But what is the best piece of advice to this person who's listening to our voices right now, who is really, really hurting? What can you tell that person?
Yeah, that's a question I get asked a lot, Hugo. And there's a few things that I'd add to the answer here is whatever is causing the hurt, whatever is underpinning the pain, know that it doesn't last for a lifetime. You're not a bad person and you don't need to justify it. You don't need to apologize for what it is that you're experiencing. We experience the discomfort of pain and hurt like we experience the enjoyment of joy and happiness and satisfaction and connection. We go through difficult and challenging phases in our life. So if people are listening to this and there's a level of hurt or pain, it's a normal part of the human experience. But what I don't want those people to do is ignore the pain and the hurt like I did for a long time, because the longer you let that run, the more difficult, the more complex, and the more impact that can have in a negative sense on your life. So recognize, okay, I'm in pain and I'm hurting. You may not know the reason why. You don't have to, but acknowledge that that's what you're experiencing. And then I think what's important is who are the people in your network that you can trust? And you may have one, you may have a couple. Make the effort of talking with them. And if it's family and friends, understand before you start talking, they aren't the experts. But when we take what's happening out of our heads and we ruminate on it and we can communicate with someone that, we're giving ourselves permission to communicate what we're experiencing.
Like the young 18-year-old Wayne who trusted you and then spoke to you.
Correct. And then I would strongly encourage people is if you've got a family GP, then make the time to go and see the GP. And the only thing that I ask is you speak very honestly about what's going on. Don't bullshit, don't lie, because they can't help you as much as they're capable of if they don't know the facts. Their job is not to judge you. They're not judging you. Their job is to help. That's the nature of why they do the work. And Izzy would know that better than I would. And then do whatever you need to do in order to recalibrate, to deal with what is causing the stress or the pain and move back to being healthy and well. And that might be getting better sleep, changing your diet, putting yourself first for a change and going, I need to say no a bit here. That's not selfish. That's not self-indulgent. That's really important that I start to care for myself. And do everything you possibly can to work through what is causing you the distress in your life. Because when we ignore it or suppress it, my experience is you can ignore it and suppress it for a period of time, but your mind and physical body has a unique ability of bringing things to the surface, whether or not you want to deal with them or not at some point in the future. And if that's you, you don't have to do that. We don't wait to get physically sick. So why would we wait to become emotionally unwell? Our brain is our motor. It impacts our ability for our body to perform and function. So I believe that it's just as important. I make decisions every day, Hugo, about my mental health. Secondary, I make decisions physically, but every decision I make through the course of each 24-hour period is primarily based on my mental health and emotional well-being, because my mental health influences my physical health.
And I imagine these are some principles that are being taught in the Foundations of Wellbeing program. And as you said, Wayne, people don't know. We're not taught how to recognize our emotions. I think Hugo and I might be the last generation that haven't grown up with it. I know my little nieces and nephews now are telling me about, you know, recognizing their feelings because they've learned it on the TV show Blowy. But our generation, we really need to learn these principles. And as you said, the sector is over-resourced and these principles need to be taught in a different way, because not everyone can see a psychologist. Not everyone financially has that as an option, and there's not enough psychologists. So the Foundations of Wellbeing project, we need to approach mental health differently, because at the moment it's not working as well as, you know, the supply and the demand is, you know, is not working when we've got one in five people suffering a mental illness.
I absolutely agree with that, Izzy. If you look at the tobacco industry, you know, tobacco industry sponsored a lot of sports internationally and locally. That's no longer acceptable. Alcohol was a primary sponsor of a lot of international and national sporting codes or events. We've changed that narrative. We understand the importance of road safety, breathalyzing, don't speed and drive, don't drink and drive, don't take drugs and drive. So we're constantly educating. And here in Victoria, we had a campaign created in 1970 called Declare War on 1034. That was in direct response to 1,034 people dying on the roads in Victoria in 1969. So I share this with you because we've had, that was 1970, it's now 2021, 51 years in Victoria alone of education about the importance of road safety. We lost 3,139 people who tragically took their lives last year. The year before, we lost 3,318 people. Four of the last 5 years, we've lost more than 3,000 people nationally who have tragically taken their lives. And on average, every year in Australia, 65,500 people are attempting to end their lives. That would make it the fifth largest city in Victoria. So the point I'm making, we're losing more people because they're taking their lives compared to 1,034 people in 1969, but we've had 51 years of education about road safety and the importance of that. We need to do this differently. And if we don't do it differently, we're going to face the same issue every single year because we're doing the same things we've always done historically. And that's the reason why Pucker Up and Foundations of Wellbeing has been created. There's more work-related stress. Burnout is a real thing, as you've articulately said, Izzy. Workloads are increasing. We've had people working from home that are now nervous about going back into the workplace. So it's like my football career. We train people to be good employees, but are we training people to cope with all of the challenges that life brings? And that's the basis and the genesis of Foundations of Wellbeing. We want to give people the skills and the toolbox that allow them to invest into their wellbeing, because healthier, happier, more engaged staff are more productive employees. Healthier, happier, engaged people are better human beings. It's not rocket science, but we believe that education is the greatest lever to achieve a different outcome.
Well, Wayne, you're doing an incredible job, and I think it's one of those things where there is so much to unpack and take away from what you're saying. And although you say it's not rocket science, there clearly is so much into it as far as no two people are the same. And I think that's also important, that something you going for a bike ride or me doing my morning yoga, it's going to be different for everyone. So I think it's important that people find what works for them, that find their, you know, their happy place. They find their, whatever it is that looks after their own mental health and wellbeing. But on that, we always like to finish off before we can do some final comments after this, but on that sort of health and wellbeing challenge, we call it, what is something that you can leave Izzy and me and the listeners, something that we can do, and we'll go away and we do it for the next week, and the listeners hopefully listening to this, well, they'll go and do it. Do you have a little health and wellbeing challenge that's something they can do which will, yeah, benefit their own mental health and wellbeing?
What is the challenge that I would encourage people? One of the things that I've observed for a long time, and I'm guilty of falling into this, is this attitude, which I believe is ingrained into our DNA in Australia. She'll be right, suck it up, push through. It's not a sustainable business model. The thing that I would encourage people who are feeling fatigued, tired, stressed, like they don't have enough time in the day, it's the most important tool in my toolbox, is sleep. And I prioritize it and I'm disciplined with it. So what I'd encourage people to do, if you want to feel like you've got more energy, if you want to feel like you have more enthusiasm to get up and do what the next day has got to do, got to present for you, just spend the next week prioritizing sleep. And the way that I would do that is, if you want to have a better quality of sleep, once again, Izzy and I have talked about this a number of times, and you're drinking every night, a few nights a week, just stop drinking alcohol for that week and try to go to bed half an hour, hour, 2 hours early if you can. And just pay attention to the type of quality of sleep that you get. Pay attention to how you're waking up through the course of that week. Do you have more energy? Do you feel more clearer? Do you feel like you've got more clarity? Can you make more decisions? Do you have a greater threshold of being able to cope with the various challenges that might play out through the course of the day? Pay attention to how you feel physically and emotionally. Sleep is the most important thing that we can give ourselves, but I don't see enough people recognizing and then prioritizing sleep. And the other reason why I prioritize sleep is, if I don't get sleep over a 2 or 3 week period, I'm inviting anxiety and depression back into my life.
And I think with mental health, we talk about the benefits of, you know, professional help and seeing a psychologist, and they're really critical, but we really, the sleep, the cutting out alcohol, eating well, doing some exercise, to me, that's my 80% of my mental health well-being. The last 10, 20% might be seeing the psychologist, but the really, you know, we can all apply them, you know, those principles to our lives. And just moving on from that, I think it's a good pathway to say, tell us a bit about the Pucker Up Ride just before we finish up the episode, because I'm sure you'll need some pretty good sleep leading into that.
It's a 3-day event, which we're super excited you're able to make it, Izzy. So we're looking forward to welcoming you into the group. But everything we do, including the bike ride, is all about the purpose and the mission. We're riding 331.8 kilometres over the course of 3 days. What's the significance of that number? It represents the 3,318 people that tragically took their lives. So it's a way of our organisation honouring the lives that were lost. And every one of those lives is a story. Every one of those people is no longer with their family and their community. So it's about honouring those people that are no longer with us and letting the families know that there are people and organisations that do care greatly about this.
And that is, I'm just going to say, that is so important, because there is still shame in suicide. And it's heartbreaking when people feel like they can't say, my son died of suicide, or, you know, my aunt died of suicide. And I don't think I've heard of an organisation honouring the people that have, you know, unfortunately been lost to suicide. So I just want to thank you for doing that. That must be impacting so many families.
Yeah, look, I really appreciate it. I just got goosebumps with what you just said there. It is important to let people and communities and families know that organisations and individuals do care. We care. We don't know them. But every one of those people that tragically ended their life, they have a story. we can't just let those statistics sit in a report, a journal, a publication, without saying every one of those people was a son, a daughter, a father, a mother, a child, a grandparent. I think it's incumbent on us to peel the veil of secrecy or shame back and go, you know what, losing somebody to suicide, it's different to losing somebody with cancer, but we don't shame people who have lost family members as a result of cancer. We shouldn't shame people that have lost people as a result of suicide. At the end of the day, we're losing human beings. Look, I'm a passionate cyclist, as you know, but cycling is the greatest metaphor for life. And what I mean by that is this, is when you ride in a group, it's incumbent on all of the riders, whether you know them well or not, you pay attention. And when you know what a tired rider looks like, what might that be? They're starting to drop out the back, starting to sweat, they're not drinking, they're starting to breathe heavier, they're a little bit wobbly, they're not giving their hand signals as they normally would. When you know what to look for, when you're on a bike, you roll over to that person and you go, you know what, are you okay? How are you feeling? Are we going to stop in 5Ks? We can pull over at the servo. I've got some water if you want some water. If you want a gel or I've got a bar, you can have that. Do you want me to give you a gentle push? That's exactly what we do in life. When we know what to look for and identify someone's having a bad day, all we need to do is walk up and say, Hugo, are you okay? Is there anything that I can do? Do you need to talk? Do I need to help you do something to get through what it is? Cycling and life are the same thing. Once we understand the cues, we can help somebody else. And that's the beautiful opportunity that I think we have.
That's a really powerful way to finish up, Wayne. I think even hearing you both talk about that, and that actually gave me goosebumps too when you said that. But the whole, there are real people behind these numbers, and it's all good and well we talk about these numbers. They're real people, and it really, really powerful to hear you say that, Wayne. And I can't wait to see how you both go on this ride.
I better get some more Swift sessions in.
Don't worry about your co-host. She's an ultramarathon runner. She's small in stature, but big in heart.
She always puts me to shame with all her bloody updates and her fitness antics. But look, I'm sure there'll be plenty of amazing conversations throughout the three-day ride, which will just be really a massive part of it. And my hat off to you both. Can't wait to see how you go. And look, Wayne, it's been such an amazing hour chat with you. It really has. Thank you so much for your time. Just to quickly recap that sort of well-being challenge, I'm going to definitely take that away. Prioritizing your sleep, you know, go to bed that hour, 2 hours before you normally do is so, so important.
Even half an hour.
Even half an hour. Thank you for sharing your words of wisdom. Thank you for being so open, honest, and vulnerable and talking about your own personal experience, but then the amazing work that you continue to do on a daily basis in this space. So I just want to personally thank you, Wayne.
I really appreciate it, Hugo. I was looking forward to the conversation. I knew it would be a good one. I appreciate the very kind words. We'll continue to do what we do, but also want to acknowledge both of you. You don't have to do these type of things, but you've made a decision, both of you, to create your podcast. It's an opportunity for people to educate themselves, to learn. And I really want to thank you both for making that commitment, because you are helping people. So long may your podcast continue. And we look forward to welcoming the very impressive Dr. Izzy Smith to Melbourne next month, and she can spend 3 days on the bike ride with us. So thank you.
Thanks so much, Wayne. Talk soon.